This is United Tribes News Radio. Insights into Native culture, people, ideas, topics to improve understanding. From United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. Only the tip of the iceberg is known about the history and culture of Native people. That's because, by and large, the Native point of view is missing. And that creates an opportunity for people like LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who make it their mission to add to the historical record. Allard is a Native culture keeper from Standing Rock and the tribe's former historic preservation officer. In this program, a talk about how tribal people need to be the ones to learn their history and to teach it to others.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Tamakawa Shtewi, her good earth woman. I'm an enrolled member of Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. I am Ihonktua, Pabaska, and Sisitan Dakota. I am Honkpapa, Sihasapa, and Oguala Lakota. And a little bit of Russian German. Got to throw that in there. You know, one of the things that we looked at after 20, 30 years of doing history of the tribes is I find out that one of the things that tribal people have missing in their lives is our history, our culture, our language, and our tradition, and our spirituality. Not by anybody's fault. It is what happened through the whole process. And so I always look at the young people and I kind of see like we're walking around with half of our pieces missing. Because I truly believe if we have our history, our culture, our language, and our tradition, and our way of life, we can make any decision, be anything. We can choose to follow culture or choose not to follow culture. We are a whole person. And so with Indigenous people, we have lost that wholeness. And so for me, studying history, who are we? Where did we come from? What is our background? What is our history with the land? Where do we stand? And I have been honored and privileged to be able to walk on many of the lands here. And so in all of my craziness, because I am a little crazy, I went from the top of the Minnesota River in Minnesota all the way to the bottom and logged and walked on each site of Dakota and Lakota. I have traveled all over North Dakota and walked through the sites. I was very honored to be able to walk through Killdeer Mountains to visit the sites. And I don't think there's any place in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Northern Colorado, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ontario, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan where our footprint has not been laid. Everybody asks me, where is your territory? That is my territory. When we talk about treaties, we talk about 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty that defines our boundaries, but those were not all of our boundaries. Because from the Heart River right here in Mandan, North Dakota, to the Platte River, to the Bighorn Mountains, to the Missouri River is according to the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. But in the Ihonktua land claims, we are from the Missouri River and all of the James River. And the Minnesota land claims are from the James River to the Great Lakes. And so if you look at our Aboriginal territory is huge. But within that territory, that was not exclusively us. That was everybody. We all lived on the land with our tribal neighbors. We all lived in these areas sharing land. And you know, if you go back and you look at the conflicts of a long time ago, does anybody know what the major conflict between tribes were? Women. The major conflict between the tribes have always been women. Did you know that? It had nothing to do with land. It had to do with women. The average marriage age of an Indian woman was 25 to 30 years old. In that time before the coming of the settlers, they held their daughters close. They protected their women. They did not allow their women to be isolated. All young girls had chaperones. And that is something that I want to bring up because of our current situations with Native women. A long time ago, we protected the women. But in order for a young man to get married, there were protocols he had to follow. So he's sitting over there and he sees this woman and, ooh, she looks nice. So he goes to his mom and says, "Mom, I really like that girl." And the mom says, "Okay, hold on." She goes over to the girl's mom. Okay, they talk. "Okay, we better talk to the grandmas." And so the grandmas get together. "Okay, well, we know so-and-so is related to so-and-so." And so the grandmas, "Okay, they're not related." "Okay, now you can talk to the men folks." So they go to talk to the grandpas. "Well, I don't remember having any conflict with them." "Okay, so now it goes to the fathers. I love my daughter. I want the best for her. So if you want my daughter's hand, you'd better bring me 20 buffalo hides to make sure she has a home. You better bring me enough horses so that she will never want anything. You better bring me the food." And so a young man would have to provide all of these before he came to collect his wife. Young men are very impatient. So sometimes the young men would go to the next tribe and steal a woman. They would steal a wife. And as I was looking at some of these old documents about this wife stealing that went on, that's where a lot of the conflicts came. So you went into the Arikara tribe and stole a Arikara woman. And then her dad and brothers come back to steal her back. And so I'm seeing these conflicts. I was looking at why did we have conflict? Basically, more or less, and it wasn't a conflict where the whole tribe went out to fight another whole tribe. It was brothers and sisters, brothers and uncles, "Hey, come help me. I'm going to go over here and steal this woman. Hey, come help me. I'm going to go get this woman back." So I was looking at these conflicts here about how we lived on the plains. Times were different, attitudes were different, and thoughts were different. So I looked at, why would anybody want to be a stolen wife? So I was reading some of these old things about, "I'm the first wife. I was stolen." And so there was a kind of a pride there. Because, you know, if you look at our culture and our way of life, you can't beat the way we live. There has never been a time where anybody lived like we did and continued to live. Because in ours, men had multiple wives. The wives always had people to help them with their chores. So nobody had to work themselves to death. There was always share of labor. A smart man would marry sisters, our cousins. It's a different culture. It's a culture that I understand. A lot of things have changed through our history, but that is just one small component about conflict. Our people traveled a great distance in this area, and in these great distances, each of them had a responsibility. So like, we would go to the Bighorn to collect wasay, the red paint. We go to the Black Hills for ceremony. We go to the Minnesota Mounds to bury the dead. Every area had a reason to travel. And we had an amazing trade network. So one of the things that I was really impressed with was these shells. You ever look at the amazing pictures of our ancestors with these shells? So I thought, where do they come from? Northern California. Our trade network was huge. It was amazing. Not everybody in the tribe went on these trading. We would have one family that went to do the trade. But we traded from all over the area. No tribe was isolated. We traded, we had networks. But what happens when you have a system like that? One of the things is these cultural rules that we had a long time ago. And you still hear about them today. That means that as I stand here, I cannot be an authority of a Rikra and talk about the Rikra tribe. It's not my tribe. I can't go over here and talk about the Crow tribe because it's not my tribe. I can talk about my tribe. It was called respect. We can talk about who we are and our people, but we didn't step over that line to become an authority of somebody else. And I look at these small components of respect that were so ingrained in our culture. Respect. So I was listening to this grandma. She was getting after me because, you know, sometimes I do and say bad things and don't do things right. And she said, do you know, we don't really have a word for love. They're making up words nowadays. And I said, okay. I said, what is the word? We don't have one. I said, well, what do we have that's close to it? Don't you know? Because grandmas get after, you know, it's respect. Respect is the closest thing we have to the word love. Respect. When you say respect, you're talking about love. You respect your elders. You love your elders. You respect your wife. You love your wife. And so I started looking at stuff and listening to a lot of the elderly people. And then I started looking around our schools. And I started looking around. You go on to res, that's the word. Respect. You come out into this world and it's, I love you, or whatever. In Indian country, you respect your elders, you respect your mom, you respect your grandma. It is the closest and more important word we have to love. And I think about these cultural ideas that we have in our tribes. And I thought, oh my God, we must come from the smartest people in the whole world. Oh yeah, we do. Because every Native person is a scientist, a humanist, can't even say that word anymore. A social gathering person, a provider. We fit so many components of this. And so when I was in college, you know, they were always asking me, why do you people burn sage? And so I was like, went home and said, Grandma, how come we burn sage? Looks at me mean like, what? Kill germs, what do you think? And I was like, oh, okay. Because when I was a little kid, she would always be smudging the house when we got sick or anything. And so, you know, I'm sorry to say, but as a kid, we had sage burning in the house when somebody was sick. We didn't always go and smudge our house like this. We burnt it when somebody was sick, and Grandma would make you drink that horrible sage tea when you were really sick. Sage has a component in it that kills germs. You can take sage water and wash the top of your counters, and it's better than the antibacteria stuff that they deliver. It kills germs. You've been around many of our spiritual leaders where they take sage and they rub their hands, their face with the sage. It is to clean germs, so they pray. When you pray, you want to be clean. So when we smudge our bodies, we're able to cleanse our bodies from germs. When you're in a large room, you can cleanse the area of germs. When we pray, we want to make sure we do everything in a good way. And so I thought that was so unique. Oh my God, we're scientists. And I always just tell people, I said, I'm always asking my grandma questions. She always get mad at me. So she said, I said, Grandma, how come we wear headbands? She'd look at me and say, well, keep the sweat out of your eyes. What do you think? Because they had to ride horses. They were out walking in the prairie. And it keeps sweat out of your eyes. As I was looking at some of these components, I thought, yeah, Indian people are really smart. Maybe we need to start teaching the rest of the world. No, just saying. Not really joking. I truly believe that. So the other thing that I learned was hair. I don't know about anybody else, but in my house, Grandma cleaned out all the brushes and rolled up the hair, and she put it in this pillowcase. But put in his pillowcase, and then once a month she would take it out and burn it. And then I remember my Aunt Tootsie, she would do that too. And now I catch myself doing that, putting all their hair so you don't leave your hair around. And then now today in scientists, they take a strand of our hair, and in that strand they tell you your whole DNA. They can tell you what you were sick from. They can tell you what you can eat. They can tell you if you ever been bad and did alcohol or drugs. But they can tell you everything about your life. Your hair is life. And our people knew that. Our hair is the essence of who we are as a people. As I go through and I find out these things, I was like, oh my God, we are scientists. As we went through and we lived on the plains, one of the things that we have a problem with today, I'm have the problem too, is our phones, iPads, our computers, our attention span. But long time ago, our people would sit and they would watch the animals. They would watch them. And everything they did, they would figure out, why did they do that? So a buffalo, they would go and they'd watch it, and it's not feeling good. And so they watch it eat this plant. Ah, medicine. So we were able to watch the animals to decide which plants to heal our bodies. And we still have that knowledge. You know, as a kid, I always tell people, I didn't really know we were that poor until we came to Bismarck Mandan and the other kids told us we were. But we didn't have a lot of things, but we made everything we had. We planted a garden, we hunted, we fished, and we lived off the land. And so every evening I remember Grandma would go collect all these plants. So we'd always have all these kind of tea. We had tea every night. I always tell people I never drank coffee until I was in college and had to do midterms, because I drank a lot of tea. And coffee was something that was kind of precious. And I joke about North Dakotans all the time, because North Dakotans drink a really light coffee. And if you go anywhere else, the coffee's really thick. And I was like, why is that? Because coffee was hard to get. Coffee was expensive. And so they used it very sparingly. And everybody got used to drinking a lighter coffee. I always like to find out these things. So back to culture. I always think that these little things are only that much about who we are. When we decided to learn about who we are again, because I'm just like everybody else. I'm a normal Indian childhood, I tell people. I grew up a very normal Indian childhood. And to be a normal Indian child in these days, it means that you are fostered, you're in relative care, you're in boarding school, you're taken by a church, and every now and then you get to live with grandma. And that's kind of my life. I was taken, I said I didn't get to go to no fancy boarding school. My husband went to Marty Mission. I had to go to St. Francis Mission in Rosebud. In the boarding schools, it's a whole lot different than what boarding schools are today. And then when I got older, the church took me. And so the Episcopal Church took me all the way to Massachusetts, where I was put in foster homes and went to school. Then the church took me to Vermont, where I went to high school, a long ways away from here, and before my grandma could get me back and I could come home again. And I thought as a child, this was only me that this happened to. And then I found out it's a normal thing. Why is it a normal thing? Who lives like that? Who grows up their whole life and has to be an adult to meet her brothers and sisters? That's a normal thing. And so I had to figure out, how did all this happen? Oh, government policy. And when I started going through and recording and reading our history, I was devastated. No, wait. I was angry. I was enraged. How dare they? And somewhere along the line, Grandma said to me again. I'd come home and say, Grandma, why is things like this? Why can't we change? And she used to get mad at me all the time. And finally she said to me, you know, it took us 100 years to get like this. It's going to take us 100 years to get well. Change takes time. Okay. She said, but I want you to know we're on the healing side now. And my grandma died in 1990. And I have this concept in my head. We are on the healing side. And as I go around to the schools and everywhere, I am seeing amazing young people come up. And these young people have something we didn't have. The ability to hear our culture, our language, our tradition, our way of life, and our spirituality. When I was a child, we would have gotten in trouble if somebody smudged. We've got in trouble for speaking our language. We got, you know, I remember as a child sitting down to eat and hearing this woman say, and don't bring any of that Indian food in my house. And I was thinking, like, what's Indian food? It's that soup and fried bread. That's not allowed here. You eat like a white person. I think about things like that, you know, about these idealisms that we were brought up with. Now, children can come into a college and eat fry bread and soup and wojapi. Kids can hear the language. Kids can hear our culture and our way of life. The other thing that I found out through this whole process was nothing's lost. Nothing is lost. Because people say, oh, the culture's gone. There's nothing. Nothing is lost. And I'll tell you, because when I was in the camp, I listened to young people sing. I listened to young people who never sang before sit at a drum. I listened to young people the first time they ever stood up and prayed. I listened to young people who were proud of who they were. I listened to young people say, I'm Lakota. I'm Mandan. I'm Cheyenne. I seen healing before my eyes. We have a long ways to go. And I truly believe the first beginning of that center is knowing who we are. Who are you? When I come home and I'd say, Grandma, who are we? And Grandma would say, keep those skeletons in a closet. We want to talk about it. And I kept on saying, well, who are we? I didn't even know what bands I came from. I didn't even know who my relatives were. And it became such an obsession for me to find out who I was related to that I just started gathering information. I know who I am. I don't really care what anybody has to say about me. I don't care if you like me or not. I know who I am. And I tell people the roots go right out of my feet. I'm from the Kennebaw River. I know who I am. And that was amazing for me. Because as a young person, I didn't like me too much. I thought I was the only person in the whole world that bad things happened to. But I wasn't. It was a general thing for Indian people. How do we change that scenario? Know who you are. So then I started talking to my dad, and I was like, well, who are we? We're Yanktenay. Well, what's a Yanktenay? And then I found out, oh, well, Ihunktawana. But we have that Pabaska, that cuthead blood too, you know. Well, what's that? Oh, wait, they come from the Siston tribe. And my mom's Hunkpapa and Siahasapa Blackfeet with that dash of Oglala from Wombly. And I was like, why didn't anybody ever tell us that? I would have liked to have known as a child. So now I tell people, who am I? And then I started looking at all my relatives. And I was like, oh my God, I'm related to everybody. That's so cool. And as I went through my relatives in Crow Creek, Lower Brule, Pine Ridge, Rosebud, Cheyenne River, Standing Rock, Spirit Lake. I'm only married into Turtle Mountain. All of these tribes, I was like, we're really more related than we're not. Then I thought, if I didn't know who I am, there are many other people out there in Indian country who don't know who they are. So I started gathering all this genealogy, and I started putting people's genealogy together. And one of the things I found is grandma started coming to me. There's this boy, he's talking to my granddaughter. I know they're related. Can you show me how? So I pull up and do all the charts and give it to the grandmother so they take them and show their grandchildren. You guys are related. Because that part was taken from us. So I told you I really have a mixed background. So as a child, and a real young child, I grew up in a place called Fort Totten, North Dakota, which is now called the Spirit Lake Reservation. And I used to live next to this big military fort. I always go up there. Our house is gone now, and the old police station was gone. But I used to live there, and I used to have a babysitter. Her name was Elvina Alberts. And every day I would go down to Elvina's house. And every day she would tell me stories about the day when we first ate dog or when we went prairie dog hunting. Or she would always tell me stories. She was just a massive amounts of stories. And so I have a connection in Spirit Lake. And at Three Affiliated, I have my nephew, wherever he went, who's a Rickra. I got to tease him all the time. And in Pine Ridge, I never knew about my relatives, the Fast Wolf and the Randalls from Wombly. But now I know who they are. The Brave Bulls and stuff. And, you know, I came here a little early today just so I can drive around United Tribes because that's my history too. Because my dad started here at United Tribes in 1969 with Jack Barden. And we lived in most of those brick buildings over there. I remember in 1969, one of the brick buildings, you go upstairs and they were all filled with bats. So many bats here when I was a kid. And I remember my dad and I used to do bad things. They went up during the day with a big broom and some garbage sacks and knocked all those bats down. And just to be funny, he went down to Kirkwood Mall and let him go in the parking lot. Sit up, bad guys. But I remember things like that. I remember United Tribes. And then, of course, my son went to school here. My cousin, the Thunderhawks, are all here. And the most amazing man that ever came into my life, Dr. Jack Barden. I am so honored to be able to live in Jack Barden's home, which his wife sold to us. And every day Jack Barden walks with me. Because if it wasn't for Jack Barden, I truly believe I would have never went to college. Jack Barden was always there, knocking at my door with a coffee and some sugar. Always there. And I would say, Jack, I can't do this anymore. These people hate me. I don't think I can do this. And he'd say, you can do it. If I can do it, anybody can do it. And when I graduated from college, I said, Jack, what am I going to do now? And Jack said, go to graduate school. I said, I can't go to graduate school. He said, I did. Anybody can. He's always telling me. So I went to graduate school. And then when I came home, I said, Jack, what do I do now? He said, you know what? The reservations are open. They are opportunities. You have amazing resources. Do not rely on anybody. Develop what you love and go with it. And I said, Jack, ain't nobody gonna listen to me. He said, do what you love. And I love history. And so I went to work for the cultural resource planner for the tribe, developed the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, the NCHRA committees. We put historic signs to Standing Rock, developed tourism, because it's what I love. And one of the things that I made a commitment to back then was I will go anywhere and talk anybody, as long as there are kids involved, to talk about history, culture, language, and tradition. And I am not an expert, and I don't know anything, but I figure everybody's in the same boat as me, and we're all going forward to learn everything we can. So, in 2014, my whole life changed. In 2014, I did not expect anything that happened in my life to happen. I figure here now that I'm in my 60s, my imagination was I would get to spend all this time researching in my books and doing genealogy for people, which I love so much. I did not perceive what was going to happen. And it started with Kildare Mountain. and going up there and walking that ground and seeing what was happening to the land, seeing what was happening to the oil development, seeing what was happening to our sacred sites, being able to walk there and be able to record that history. And I remember Wash Dewey, when she called me to the office and said, LaDonna, you better come look at these maps. They're proposing a pipeline. Well, where at? She said, look. I said, right outside our home? That's when everything changed. I sat down and started recording the history of the Cannonball River. Does anybody know what that area is? Does anybody understand what that area is? So as you know, you got the two twin buttes where the origination of the Mandan people came from as they emerged into the world after the second great flood. And as you go to the another site where the Okipa was created, when you go to the village site of the Mandan people, this whole Mandan village was decimated, 2,000 people in 1801. And you go right across to the Rikara village, and you go to the flat tops of the hills, and you see those effigies of the turtles and the eagles all laid in rock. And you go down to that area, and you see the old campsites. And as everybody knows, you just go down little ways down a Cannonball there, and that's where Sitting Bull's father was killed. Do you know the history of the land? So fast forward, we started a camp. And I remember coming down, must have been about June, maybe end of May. And I walked into the camp, and there was everybody sitting there around the fire. It was very small then. And they had the American horse ladies over here, and they were gabbling, cutting meat and hanging it and drying it. And the men over here were sitting around the campfire, and they were roasting deer meat over the grill. And I stood there, and I said, wow, this is how we're supposed to live. But what amazed me is not one person there was speaking English. They were all speaking Dakota. And they were telling stories about what it was like to live on the river. They were telling stories of their grandparents. And the kids were running around, climbing on the trees, and dogs were running through. And I thought, I think this is how we are supposed to live. We are supposed to live with the earth. And so I was so amazed. But what was really amazing, I came down, I think about 4 days later, and there was another group of people, and they were all speaking Lakota. I said, so cool. And then I came down, and they were speaking Mi'kmaq. We had a whole group of people from Canada, which were a mixture of Cree, Chippewa, and French. And I thought, this is how we keep ourselves alive, by understanding these components of who we are. And for me, the camps were the beginning of reliving who we were. I don't really, all the conflict and the hardship and the military's action and everything else that happened, it was what happened in the camps. We still have our core culture, that song, that dance, that ceremony, that history of who we are. And what we need to do is be telling each young person that. I have the great honor and benefit of being one of those people who still had grandma telling me stories. And what I am finding out is there is two whole generations that never got to hear grandma's stories in their families. There is nobody sitting down the kids at night and talking about stories. You know, when I was a kid, we'd do bad things. We'd make fun of grandma all the time because she'd start the story. And we heard it so many times, and we finished off her story. But I did not realize that was a teaching method. Those stories got told repeatedly, so they ingrained in our head. and we remembered them. I remember the stories. Now, how do we continue that tradition? How do we continue to tell those stories? Because right now, I don't know about anybody else, but I really think our world is in trouble. And we need to start telling the stories. We need to tell our history, our culture, our language, and our tradition. We need to be taken out of our comfort zones and start talking to the kids, start talking to the babies, start talking to these young people about who we are, about how we live. Go back to Killdeer. One of the things that we had a meeting, I think it was up in Watford City, and we were talking about the history of that land and the culture and where people were, because it's just like any other land in North Dakota. There's Mandan camps, and there's Arikara camps, there's Hidatsa camps, there's Lakota camps, there's Dakota camps. So there's all of these tribes intertwined between this whole area. I found out that 1910 was the year that most of the people migrated to that part of the country. And when they came in 1910, they had no knowledge of the history of that land. And as we go through and we drive by areas and say, well, we know what that is. We know what that is. We don't have a mechanism to tell those stories. So for me, I've always envisioned, how do we do this? How do we tell the stories of the land just in North Dakota here, in South Dakota here? How do we tell the history of the land? And we need help doing that. One of the things that I always tell people that I learned in college was media is important. Media is the center. And so for me, I kind of wish that we can get out to all the elders and videotape them. Because I'm not too cool on written word yet. I'm still having a little issue with putting things down in writing, because I'm not quite sure it belongs in writing yet. I'm still kind of trying to get over that loop, because I know we have to change our narrative and how we do things. But these oral stories, there were people in the 60s, 70s, and 80s who went around and did oral stories of people. And as I go listen to some of these oral stories, they are treasures. But where are they now? The universities have them in their collections. I think the tribes should have these in their collections. My great-great-grandfather, Tatanka Ohitika, was recorded by Frances Desmore, that lady who did the wax cylinders. And so they recorded the stories, and I remember listening to him, because they sent me the disc they transferred. And it was so amazing to hear him sing from the 1900s, all these songs. And I thought, wow, we should be doing more of this. I am so honored to be able to hear his voice. And they also have the story of how he obtained his medicine. And if it wasn't for Frances Desmore, I would have never known any of this. But with that, there are so many of these stories recorded out there that we don't have access to. And I really would like Indian Country to be able to have access to these histories, because they're out there. And we have amazing histories. So on the bad side, because I will tell you I say bad things, for me, everything that's happening around us, to me, in my own mind, are acts of terrorism. Because I see people trying to take our footprint off the earth. When we put in the rock this turtle effigy, it should stay there. If we went to this place and prayed, it should be preserved. If we made this petroglyph, it should stay there. Our footprint on America should stay. And so for anybody to remove these, to me, is an act of terrorism. And I'm sorry about that. I really feel like that. I believe our footprint needs to stay. I want, and 2,000 years from now, to say, oh, this site is Dakota. This site is Arikara. This site is Mandan. I want people to acknowledge who we are. And I truly believe that as Indigenous Native people, we have the roots growing right out of our feet, right down into the earth. My grandma used to tell me that. We have the roots in our feet. Remember that. I remember, you know, when you're raised in all kinds of homes, you know, and I remember I come home and I said, Grandma, all I want is a home. And she said, what are you talking about? I want a home. I want some place that I can call my own. I want a home. And she said, no. The minute you put your feet on this ground where your ancestors stood, your home. Your home, as long as your feet are on the ground. And it took me a while to understand that. I understand that now. And so everywhere I walk, I am home. Like United Tribes, because I grew up here. This is my home. When I pull in here, I walk around tribes. And I remember as a kid, I even remember 1969 powwow. It was a little tiny powwow out there. This is my home, too. Your home is where your feet are. And your home is where your roots go right into the ground. And I think if we change our world thought, we have a center then. As Native people, we have a center. Because sometimes, as Native people, we kind of feel a little lost sometimes. You know, because they have all kinds of categories for us. The urban Indian, the res Indian, the educated Indian, the uneducated Indian, the full blood, the mixed blood, the half-breed, whatever they want to call us. To me, as long as you have those roots growing out of your feet, you belong to the land. And that is the most important thing in the world. So what is culture? It's another thing I ask Grandma. What is culture? Why is everybody saying culture? What is it? Well, I learned culture is morals and values to live by. Why is people killing each other over culture? Morals and values to live by. How do you live with your fellow man? How do you be kind to each other? How do you respect each other? It's basically it. And for, I don't know about anybody else, for my culture makes sense to me. I don't want to be anybody else. I don't want to live in anybody else's culture. I like the way I live. I got all my grandkids around me. Maybe so, too much sometime. I think you have to choose who you are. And somewhere along the line, you have to understand you have a choice. I have seen some young people who said, I choose to learn my culture, and they do it. I choose to learn my language. I choose to learn my history. They made a choice, which changed their lives. Back to the camps. I remember this young man. He comes from a very hard family. His parents drink a lot. He's never had a lot. He grew up and married. They drank a lot. His wife ended up going to jail. He ended up having 5 children to take care of. And he came to camp. So no drinking. He said, okay. He was stayed at camp. He was doing really good at camp. And then when I seen him, I was like, what are you doing? He said, well, I probably did something dumb. I signed up for college. It's like, whoa, that's a great thing. I've been sober ever since I've been at camp. That's even better. I just got custody of all my kids. Cool. I'm trying to set up a system so when my wife gets out, I can help her. That's choice. There's a lot of these stories now. And I'm really proud of each and every one of them. To me, if you know who you are, your culture, your tradition, your way of life, your spirituality, you can do anything. We can even take over the world. Just joking. Okay, I have an issue. I want to take over the world. Not knowing who you are, you'll spend your whole life looking for that. not understanding who you are, you'll spend your whole life looking for that. But once you find that center, you got everything. Nobody can tell you who you are. Only you can do that. And by learning our history, our culture, our language, and our way of life. And I'm telling you, if you go around United Tribes, you have people here that can help you. We are all in a process of relearning who we are. And I'll be truthful, there is no experts. We are all in a process because we have 500 years of enculturation, genocide, assimilation, capitalism, all of these isms that we have to figure out how we're going to live. And I think that right now in this time and space, if you know your history, your culture, your language, and your way of life, your spirituality, you can do it. Because you have that center. You have this seventh direction. When I was all the years, we've been going to ceremony stuff, and I was just like, and you got the four directions, and you got the sky and the earth. And Wani, I said, well, what is the seventh direction? And you know how they look at you? You. Well, nobody ever told me that. We do have to make sure this heals. We have to make sure that this seventh direction has balance. I get uppity every now and then. And so they told me, well, LaDonna, you know about historic trauma. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if that's really true. Historic trauma, I said, you know, I understand. I went to boarding school. I did, you know, my own history, but I don't know about my past. And then they finally told me, LaDonna, we want you to come over to Whitestone and speak. Anybody who knows about the Whitestone Massacre, oh, wait, most of North Dakotans don't know about the Whitestone Massacre. And as I was going through this whole history of the massacre, I found out that my great-great-grandma's the only recording they have of the events that happened that day as I went to the documents. And so I went to my cousin Elaine and talked to her and started gathering all this and Agatha and all these people, and they started putting all the pieces together. And so I said, okay, I'll go over there. I'll talk about this event. And I told my husband, I said, well, we got to go over, you know, I want to make sure I have buffalo wasna and some berries and tobacco and water, you know, hauled in our tobacco ties. We went over there. We got over there. We pulled up. They have a kind of a stone fence there. Pulled up and I said, I want to walk in. And I just stepped on that ground and I could not talk. It was like this whole world of grief just welled up. And in my mind, I kept on saying, what is wrong with you? This didn't happen to you. This is not you. This happened to your ancestors. It's not you. And as we went up there and we put everything in a tree and we made our offerings, and I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And my husband just said, sit on the ground and pray. And I was like, how can I hurt so bad? This did not happen to me. It happened to my people. How come it hurts so bad? And so now I understand that it is something that we experience. And I know that it's a very true emotion for me. When we sit down and actually look at who we are and our ancestors, we find out sometime really bad things happened. And so, you know, we can suffer through many different emotions, but one of my emotions was, okay, I'm going to tell everybody what happened here. The more I speak it, the more people acknowledge it, the more we can heal. If we do not experience our trauma, we cannot go forward. And so right now, in this time and space, I tell everybody, holy man, I am a survivor. That means I'm meaner and tougher than anything to ever walk this earth. That's how I look at Native people of this land. We are tough. My grandma used to say, she always used to say bad things, you know. She'd say, you know us, we're going to be the last one standing along with the cockroaches and coyotes because nothing can kill us. She said, maybe we're still here. We should be using that strength that we have to start teaching the young people, to start helping them through their trauma. Because if I inherited historic trauma, so did they. And for us to go forward, we're going to have to all heal together. And how do we do that? Knowing who you are. culture, tradition, language, spirituality, and our way of life. I do know that if we have those components again, we can be whole people and heal, because our history is amazing. I love North Dakota history. I really would encourage people to learn more about it, along with our Indigenous history. So if anybody knows our ancient history, in the Williston area is where a lot of our major sites are, as far as Lakota, Dakota people. Has anybody heard of Cave Hills? So Cave Hills is located in the western part of South Dakota. If you've been to Cave Hills, I have. All the area is lined with petroglyphs, and there's burials. And when I went there, they were able to show me where Sitting Bull Camp, where Crazy Horse Camp, where Red Cloud Camp. You can see all the old campsites because it is a very sacred area. We don't go there anymore. And I think we need to remember these spots. One of the reasons why we don't go there is because in the 30s and 40s and 50s, they developed uranium mines there. And now we have open pit uranium mines that are toxic. But this is a very sacred area. One of the things that I'm finding is a lot of our sacred areas become target for these destructive environmental issues. But Cave Hills, according to a long time ago, is where the first vision came before the great flood covered the earth. And we went down into the caves, and through the caves we traveled down into area which would be our home, Wind Cave. So this is the area before Wind Cave, where we went down underground when we lived in the cave, before the water subsided, we emerged back into the world. I wonder, are we losing these stories? I would encourage everybody to go visit these areas, to go see them themselves, because they're still there, to go over there. When we went with a whole group of spiritual leaders, and we were able to paint the red paint in each one of these effigies that are on the walls, and they're old. And I think we should all know about these areas because they're still there. One of the things that I had the honor and privilege when I was up at Killdeer Mountains, as we come up to this area where these great big pits in these rocks were, and you could see huge pits where they dyed hides in. The rocks still have remnants of the old natural dyes. And I was like, wow, what an amazing spot. There are many of these things that still exist out there. If we do not go and see, acknowledge, they could be lost. I encourage everybody to know your land. Go out, because our landscape is changing fast. Go out and see these places. Go out, leave tobacco, water. Remember these places, because they're important. But anyway, I don't know if anybody knows, but I really got a big mouth and I really can talk a lot. And I don't want to take any more time talking, but if you guys have any questions, I will tell you I do have an obsessive problem with history. I love history and I love genealogy and I love seeing how everybody's connected to each other and to the land. And I think that each of us should make an effort to go out and see these areas and see these spots, to walk them, to acknowledge them, because they're still here. For me, I have learned one thing. I truly love this land, and I really don't want to live anyplace else but North Dakota. And so it is my home. I think wherever your homes are, you need to go out and see what you have there. Go out and find out what is there, because we've only have a tip of the iceberg of our history here. And I also know there is nobody else that's going to be able to teach it, to tell us, except us. We have to do it. I was telling people, we are at the time and space of our life where we have to change a narrative. It has to be a narrative from us. We have to be telling the story now. We have to be the ones to teach our own children.
That was LaDonna Brave Bull Allard in a talk at United Tribes Technical College. In 2016, she formed Sacred Stone Camp along Cannonball River to host water protectors gathered to resist construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. The movement eventually attracted an estimated 10,000 indigenous people and environmental activists, making it perhaps the largest intertribal gathering of Native people in North America in centuries. Allard also worked in tribal tourism, learning to love North Dakota history. But much or most of what she knows is sourced from oral and visual knowledge handed down within the culture, from oral histories, winter counts, and pictographs. This program was produced by the United Tribes Technical College Office of Public Information. Dennis Newman, Director, Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, Producer. This series is designed to provide insight and improve understanding of tribal culture and Native people. For more information, visit our website at uttc.edu.